My name is Nayaswami Hriman. I'm here this week with Padma, my wife. We serve in the greater Seattle area at the Ananda Community and Meditation Temple there. We reflected recently that we've been there 18 years. Incredible. I've had the opportunity, the privilege, and the great blessings which seem to continue of a recent pilgrimage to India. And I will therefore leverage on that to use that analogy here today. But one of the great blessings started with the fact that the whole idea was that of my daughter, Gita, who was born and raised here at Ananda Village many years ago. And this last weekend has moved back to Ananda Village. So please welcome, would you please stand? I could not have made the trip without her. She took good care of her old fuddy-duddy dad who couldn't find his way out of a sleeping bag, but we had a very, very wonderful time. Life is, of course, very much an analogy to pilgrimage. It is indeed a journey to self-realization. And so the analogy holds up rather well. When we think of the yamas, particularly niyamas, and the beginning stages of our journey, when it seems like we're having to give things up, at least that's the focus the ego has. And in most kind of orthodox religionist view, in the more superficial view of the spirituality, you have those who give up this and those who give up that. And so that characterizes much of the world's view of spirituality in orthodox terms. Well, on this pilgrimage to the Himalayas, of course, there were a lot of things we gave up, and it started with Starbucks, which not easy for some of us from Seattle. But there are many things you just have to transcend. The heat, the cold, the bugs, the food, the possibility with each bite you take that you're going to end up in a hospital, all of these kind of errant, random thoughts of ego protection, or as Dr. Peter might have said yesterday, the reptile brain on overload with everything that you see, it really is an invitation to go within. You don't have much choice in a place like India and in the mountains of the Himalayas, or you simply can't survive. Gita commented the other day that, you know, I think of myself as pretty hale and hearty and up for about anything, she said, but I discovered I sort of like comfort. And so I had traveled in this way many, many years ago when I was about her age, so I had at least some inkling of what was involved with it. But that's very much like the spiritual path in the beginning. We focus somewhat, perhaps too much, on the things that we're giving up. And it makes for great stories, just as in our trip. It makes for great stories about the bugs who crawled out of my shorts in the middle of the night. Going to the bathroom when something about this big hits you square and you're smacking in the forehead. You don't know quite what it is, but you're hoping it's benign. And all of those sorts of fun stories. Padma texted me and asked me for a report for our friends in Seattle. And I have to admit, I was a little grumpy about having to think about, I guess both of us, Gita and I, were very deeply involved with going within. And so I managed to put something together. But one of the things that you experience on the spiritual path, because when you withdraw through the centers, when you withdraw from looking to the world for fulfillment, you go through, as Arjuna does and reports in the first and second chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, a kind of loneliness. You think you're a little bit crazy. You perhaps are losing a lot of your old-time friends, people you went to the bar with or whatever it was. And you kind of wonder, is it really all worth it? And there on this journey up through the Ganges and into the mountains and so forth, the two of us with our guide, Mahavir, who many of you know, who's guided Ananda tours now for decades, and his faithful driver, Satendra, I reported that, you know, you're stripped to the flesh, you're stripped to the bones, no privacy, no comforts, you're down to the bare essentials of living. One time we were at one place and Gita realized, this is one of the very first nights out on the road up in the mountains, and you know, there aren't showers there. There's a spigot, and there's a plastic bucket that looked like it was used to paint the building. And she realized she had to do a bucket shower. Well, okay, so define cleanliness. You know, what is it? Define taking a shower. How often do you need one of those? You get down to the essentials. Well, one, I hope the more delicate among you will forgive my story here, but there we were, and you know, you spend a lot of hours driving up and down bumpy roads from river valleys, thousands of feet to mountaintops, and back down again, and so on and so forth, and it's kind of rough on your bladder. And after stopping at every tea stall at the top of every mountain, and finally at one point, I said to Satendra, you got to stop. I just got to go. And along the way, you find these variations of outdoor latrines along the road for the pilgrims heading into the mountains. And this one that I happened to spy that I asked him to stop for was this rather nice-looking tiled outdoor urinal, put it bluntly, facing the street. You know, the cars are going by right there. And excuse me. And so, you know, by this point, I was out, you know, you're just out there. You just live on the street and so forth. So I turn and face the thing, and I'm doing my business, and I realized that the urinal had no plumbing, and it went straight down on my shoes. And I realized the ridiculousness of what I was doing standing there on myself. And I said, oh, what the heck. I managed to find a mud puddle between me and the car and dash through with my shoes and jump back in the car. You know, you're just stripped to the essentials. But you know, along the journey, every so often you'd come around a curve, and it seemed like there were nothing but curves. There weren't any straightaways that I remember. But anyway, you come around a curve and suddenly there it was, the Himalayas. You know, the snow-clad peaks. And of course, like those of us from the Northwest, when we see the mountains come out, literally on the freeway, it takes your breath away. And so it is. That's why I'm here. This is why I've come. And so all along the Eightfold Path of our awakening, of course, we have these glimpses. But in the three higher stages, the three final stages, something else begins to happen. There are many ways that I have found, both in my teaching these last 18 years of the Raja Yoga Course, but I'd like to say far more importantly, because in my effort to share, of course, I want to understand. I want to share from at least some level of realization. And so I've used various devices by which I've come to understand and to explore the different stages along that journey. One of them is that we know the first stanza of Patanjali is that, and now we come to the practice of yoga. And we also understand from Yogananda's commentaries on Patanjali that what this means is now we have come in our journey of life to the realization of the need to go within, and that what we seek in life is not to be found without. And he describes that as the essential awakening that in India is termed the philosophy, if you will, the realization, if you prefer, as I do, of Shankhya. That realization that the world is not what it appears. Like that urinal, it was not quite what it appeared. In fact, that's one of the charms of India. Nothing is quite what it appears. The sadhus may not really be sadhus, they warn the tourists. And so with every conversation that you strike up, there's always some certain amount of your mind that's saying, okay, where's this going and what does he want? We came out of the temple, I think it was in, not Gangotri, oh, Kedarnath. Beautiful temple. It has these magnificent statues, stone statues of the Pandavas. And if you want to go a place where the living, not just the history, but the vibration of the path of self-realization lives. It's in this region of India known as the Devabhumi, the abode of the gods, where spirit and nature rise in jubilation, the vibration of rishis down through thousands of years in the highest states of samadhi. You see, even today, at whatever level they may be, the sadhus marching, trudging along the roads on their way into the mountains. Can you imagine here in the Sierras if sadhus wandered these mountains and people honored and respected that? Can you imagine the vibration of this country, as in fact I know will someday exist from places of pilgrimage such as we have here at Ananda? Well, people will come from the dusty hot plains as they do in India. Can you imagine the draw? Think about it. Yogananda was compelled as a young person, as a young man, to seek the Himalayas. I realize so strongly what a dynamic, creative, powerful symbol those mountains mean to the peoples of India and how they all long to go there. Well, it's a metaphor. We don't have to go there, because those Himalayas are within ourselves. And so, I'm sure I lost my train of thought several minutes ago, but in any case, on that inner pilgrimage, then we have these sights, we have these glimpses, but we have to do the work, we have to make the sacrifice to go the distance. It wasn't many decades ago, you know, when to go to these sacred shrines, which are all at the headwaters of the different rivers, the Ganges most famously, the Yamuna and other headwaters of the Ganges, because nothing is as it seems. There's not just one thing called the Ganges. There's, I lost count of how many things were the Ganges, and somehow they all converge down by Devaprayag, I think is a little town. It's quite beautiful, and it's called the Ganges, but anyway, whatever they call it, it has a magnetism and a power and a vibration. Ah, yes, we are at Kedarnath, and these beautiful, just powerful images of the Pandavas, who are, for all intents and purposes, in one form or another, Arjuna, as a prior incarnation of Yogananda, he said, are part of this spiritual path. And so we had a wonderful experience there, notwithstanding the push of the crowds and the yelling and shouting. I whispered to Gita, I couldn't see what they were all doing. I said, you know, it looks like a roulette table in Las Vegas here. And then I got down to the rock, which is said to be the hump of Shiva, and started to put the ghee on it. And just suddenly, you know, it's as if all that receded into the background. And I was just transported. It was an incredible experience. And then, duality being what it is, as we stepped out of our, you know, they don't let you hang in there very long, it's you're pushing and shoving and so on. Anyway, so we come out, and then there's these two sadhus, just, I mean, I wish I could have taken a picture of them. They were just a case, but basically it was really obvious when they saw us, and we were very few Westerners anywhere that we went, and it was mostly Indians, and they caught a sight of us, and it was really obvious what they wanted was money. And I just smiled. I'd seen it before, and I think Gita confessed that she was a little annoyed, and she wasn't feeling well, and ate the wrong thing the other day, and had a horrible time, and bravely got on a pony and went up the mountain with us. I don't know, the pony somehow, you know, kept things from coming out, I guess, but I admired her pluck and her courage. But so she was in a bit of a foul mood, as she puts it. And these fake sadhus were just too much. And so there you have it, you know. Aren't we fake sadhus once in a while? I've lived most of my adult life in communities meditating with people. And how many people come to the ashram to meditation just to show somebody else they can meditate 2 hours? I guess that's a better motivation than not coming. But you see, the path is very tricky. Our motivations and our temptations along the way. But throughout the path, those glimpses of those inner Himalayas, we are blessed with those glimpses. And so it is when we come to the three final stages. Patanjali calls it samyama, and which are, I'll say them, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. And as you can see from the list, fortunately, I don't have to try to spell them. You can see them right here. And they represent then, I was saying earlier, it's as if the first two and a little bit of the third represent that insight and the magnetism and the power of that insight of Shankya, the realization that the world is not as it seems, that draws us in to practice yama, to adhere to right attitude, right action, right sadhana, as it were, which draws us within and begins the journey upwards towards those inner Himalayas. And then we practice yoga. The heart of yoga is, as Gyandev described, pranayama leading to pratyahara, cleansing of the heart, purifying and refining the feelings of the heart in order to shut off the noise of the world and of the senses. And all of that through the narrow passageway of the neck, because each of these aligns with the chakras. Now, that list is sort of upside down relative to the chakras, but in any case, each of these stages have a vibrational alignment. The Eightfold Path is holographic. It's not literal. It's not linear. And yet, for the sake of our mind and our understanding, there are these tools that we can use to grapple that. Because the final three stages then represent the promise, the realization of Vedanta. What is the goal of life? I was sort of hoping Gyandev would reward us with his, I don't know what you call them, but your yoga awards. Yes, awards of the most trivialized example of the use of yoga to sell all sorts of things on our planet. And the tendency in human nature to trivialize the spiritual path, and definitely the practice of yoga, which is odd enough, is everywhere in the pages of yoga magazines, yoga celebrities, and chanting celebrities, and all of those ego things lie as traps along the way. But even in the highest stages, you know, and Patanjali talks about how samyama, which is to say the three stages of dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, can also still, in an odd sort of way, is an aspect of Shankhya, because in the body of wisdom represented by Shankhya are those mantras, those powers, the siddhis that arise with the practice of yama and niyama by which we demonstrate control over natural and metaphysical forces, astral and physical forces, lie await there, so that through the practice and the realization of the higher centers, you have the temptation warned against by great yogis. In fact, on one, you know the story of Tatakeshwar in the autobiography of a yogi. I won't retell it for the sake of time, but nonetheless, Yogananda, in his flight to the Himalayas, only after 6 months of being with his guru, he got lost and so on. Again, I won't recite that story. Well, the exact same thing happened to Gita and I. I'm a map studier, so I saw on the map Tatakeshwar. So, Mahavir, can we go to Tatakeshwar? Have you read the story? And he didn't remember the story, so I recited it to him. I had my Kindle, and he went to Rajbanpur and ask your people if they know about, Ram Gopal Muzumdar, and where's the village of Rajbanpur? I got all excited about this, because nobody I'd known ever been to Tarakeshwar. And so he was sort of flummoxed, and he's a real networker. He asked the villagers, he asked this person, he used his cell phone to call that person. Well, he just didn't know, but he said, the only Tarakeshwar I know of otherwise is in southern India. Well, I said, I know it's up here somewhere. And so, okay, after 2 days of hard driving and just through the mountains, over the woods and dales, jungles and forests and so forth, we came to this place. And of course, as you already know, it was not Tarakeshwar. Yes, it was called Tarakeshwar, don't get me wrong. But in fact, Tarakeshwar was a great demon, and he was slain here. And yogis have been coming to this place for centuries to gain yogic powers. Now, I didn't know that till after we meditated. There's a beautiful place surrounded by deodar trees at the top of a mountain, fog rolling through. It was just a wonderful experience. But I thought it was the other Tarakeshwar, and so I was saying all these healing prayers and so on, if you know that story. It's like Fatima or Lourdes, and oh well, so much for that, but I tried. And so we got up to the inevitable, the ineluctable, the ubiquitous tea stall that sits in every parking lot. And of course, the guys sitting there, as guys are always sitting in tea stalls, yakking all day. I don't know what they do, but that's what they do. And so one of them spoke English, and so I inquired, well, this was wonderful, but something doesn't seem right. He said, oh no, Tarakeshwar is in Bengal. Rajbanpur is a Bengali name. And so, okay, so we flunked that test. And so we got lost also in Tarakeshwar. So there are many, many detours on that journey to the Himalayas. one thing you learn on the spiritual path, which is where devotion and the priceless gift of the guru enters the picture, is when I encounter people, which I do every day because of what I do, who either misunderstand or even positively resist the teaching of guru disciple, and I understand that. I had to go to India 35 years ago and learn the hard way how difficult it was to find my path. And after spending over a year traveling, much of that time up and down every nook and cranny of India and the Himalayas, coming up empty, and like Dorothy and Toto, clicking my heels and realizing it was all at home, as I was soon to discover. And you realize that in meditation, in the practice of meditation, anybody who seriously tried to meditate and to achieve higher consciousness, you know how difficult it is. You know how difficult it is to focus your mind. And so the great blessing of a true guru with a true technique and so forth is essential on the spiritual path. And so it is that those Himalayas, if you will grant us glimpses of their glory as we round the curves of life and bump and grind, as it were, up and down, more up and down sometimes than forward on our lives. But with the grace of Guru, we don't get lost, or not as lost as often, perhaps, because the traps everywhere along the way are there, even in these three highest stages. Now, dharana, the first of the three stages, means technically concentration. It's of two types. It's the ability to concentrate based on the blessings and power of pratyahara to interiorize the minds, the ability to hold steady the image of one's chosen deity, guru, and so forth. But that's just the beginning stage. The other aspect of dharana is to hold steady those glimpses of the promised land. We may hear om all throughout the path, but we can't keep it. We may see the light, but we can't keep it. We may feel peaceful, but it goes away. We know from that experience that we can't, by willpower alone, hold the image of superconsciousness. In dharana, then it appears steady to the inner sight. But there's a problem. Same problem I had in India. I was still there. And so it is dharana aligned with the Ajna chakra at the negative pole, the seat of ego. That I is observing my peace. That I is listening to om. Yes, blissfully, fine. But it is still the sense of I. It is only when that I moves forward, as it were, to the kutastha chaitanya, to the kutastha, and merging in that experience of peace, or any of the eight aspects coming up the chakras, peace, wisdom, energy, love, calmness, the inner sounds, the inner light, and bliss. And it's only when we have that experience, which goes beyond the words, because we can't construct, there's no construct of the intellect that doesn't include a noun, verb, and an object. There's always an I there. Nothing is lost when that I becomes peace, when that I becomes om. But that's still, as it were, in the causal. It's still the reflection of the pure soul. And it's only in samadhi that we go beyond the three bodies, beyond the three worlds, and into all of them simultaneously. You know, I can't speak from realization. I remember a woman student came up to me years ago. She said, well, okay, so samadhi. You know, I gave the eighth class on the Eightfold Path that night. What are you thinking? Maybe 6 months? I said, maybe. For you. But nonetheless, if you listen and read sensitively to the accounts of the cosmic consciousness, there is no one state. Somebody from the 60s like me might say it blows your mind. It's a mind-blowing experience. Well, that doesn't really say anything. It can be, as it were, a void. It can be, what does it mean to be incarnate as a great warrior, which Yogananda said, while free, while an avatar, and conduct battles? When Kriyananda asked him, what's that like? What's it mean to be an avatar and kill people, or whatever it was, great generals like he had to be when he was William the Conqueror? He says, Yogananda said, you never lose your sense of inner freedom. That's Nirvikalpa Samadhi. From Sabhikalpa Samadhi, when we, as it were, are inert and in that state of cosmic consciousness, whatever form that takes, we come out of it. And we can still fall spiritually, Yogananda said. But in Nirvikalpa Samadhi, even when we achieve that and are free, we may have many lifetimes yet to be freed. We could care less. We could do it quickly. We could not do it at all. There's no way to define the state of infinity. Yogananda said, and I recite it every day, he said, recite my poem, Samadhi. And through the vibration of that recitation and the attunement that I aspire to have while reciting it, one feels at least some element of that. I want to close because of time, but because how can we take these three states with us? Because they are as present to our consciousness now in Yama, in the perfection of Ahimsa, as they are in any other point of view. In Dharana, for example, if we see in others, in life circumstances, in challenging people, in challenging health, relationships, and so on, if we see the hand of God, the grace of Guru, the peace potential of each person, we see those higher states. We view, we look for those higher states. And in that looking, bit by bit, we too become those states and thus achieve a kind of dhyana. When we walk down the, you know, in India, you don't dare just sort of be open to anybody because some guy will grab your hand and read your palm, or Lord knows what's going to happen. So you sort of have to really stay inward, and no matter what you're doing. You're never alone in India, by the way, no matter where you are. Even at the top of Everest, it's like a parking lot, I'm told. So in that, however, you can still bless people. You can still feel the space that surrounds you, the divine presence in that space. And of course, in samadhi, what can you do but feel the oneness in our life that surrounds us? All life is a pilgrimage. And I will say that the outer pilgrimage does have its blessings. My pilgrimage was a completion of a pilgrimage that didn't find closure 35 years ago, and found closure now with my own daughter. And the great blessings of that experience continue in my life in many, many ways, most of which I hold locked in my heart, but over time perhaps can find appropriate manifestation. There are, and many I see here today, have gone to such places, and all of us have come to this place of pilgrimage, because it's nothing less than that. We are establishing places of God realization throughout the world through these Ananda communities. Even our city centers, people come in from the rough and tumble of the city and feel instantly a wave of peaceful blessing. And the masters are present there if we will be instruments for their presence. And in that way, how much time it take, how many incarnations it take, it doesn't matter. It becomes at a point like lifting your sail, getting beyond those waves that were talked about yesterday, Bharat, diving in those waves and coming up in the sattvic vibration, lifting that sail, and it becomes effortlessly liberating.